Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. Now, yesterday we kind of talked about that slave clause, and we kind of talked about some of the issues, regarding the 1808, and we stepped into a few things regarding slavery. And folks, there is so much misinformation regarding the Constitution that if you just listen to everything you hear, then you can be misled and you can literally become an enemy to the state, because there are organizations out there trying to convince you that the U.S. Constitution is the problem, it is the evil within, and that you must absolve your citizenship and become a state national. And the real appeal that most of these people have is you don't have to pay taxes and you can, you know, kind of run around. Now, I don't know. So welcome back, Sean. Welcome back. Because I want to kind of steer this into some clarity. Now, recently there was a lady that got pulled over by police that claimed that she was a state national in Florida. Did you see that video?
I don't believe I saw that one. I have seen several similar situations.
All right, so some of these people believe that they have a right to drive on the roads, the highway systems, and so forth. Because somewhere back there, somebody said, you can't take a right and make it turn it into a privilege. Well, so back in the old days, you had a privilege of being able to get on your horse and ride it anywhere you wanted to, as long as you didn't go over somebody's fence or fence line or onto property that was clearly marked stay off, correct?
Yes, sir.
And so when people were developing, and, you know, as we were migrating west, there were no road systems. What happened was people chose to follow the horse trail that was created by a couple of families living out in town, and they just followed that. And then when they had to break away from, you know, what was existing, everybody just kind of continued on. And that became a route, a road, or trail, actually. This was technically, it was a trail. And eventually wagons, you know, rode down it and so forth. And so our road system was developed that way. Our road system was developed by the most direct and ease of transportation, or ease of getting from point A to point B. 9 times out of 10, if you lived on the other side of a tall mountain, you went around the mountain to get to town. Not too many people thought the best way to town is in a straight line. Because even though on a map it may be shorter, depending on the height of that mountain, you could actually be spending a lot more effort and time going even further up in elevation and then back down in elevation just to get to town by avoiding the natural terrain features, you know, rivers, you know, big, thick thickets of trees and brush. So that I'm not going to fight that. I'm trying to go the path of least resistance, because that's how it was done. And so 9 times out of 10, it was very common that they just took the path of least resistance to get to town. Now, as we started organizing and we started growing in communities, and town folk started living closer to town, and the people that had their farms and ranches lived outside of town, just, you know, far enough to, you know, keep to themselves and have their livestock and keep people's noses out. You know, they didn't have a lot of Mrs. Kravitz's in the neighborhood, if you know what I mean. And so they established this road system that was at no cost to anybody. It was just, you know, we're making it up as we go along. So anybody that got onto a road or a trail like that had the right of travel on it. All of a sudden, as things started changing, when people started owning property, and next thing you know, all the property around town was owned. And the only way that they may have still used these roads, but they never formalized the easements. You know what an easement is, right, Sean?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So an easement is one of these things that gives you the right or the permission to travel on a given route or a given road, or to basically cross over somebody's property or in between property. And so there was a lot of work done in engineering and separating property for road systems or for the movement of people from private property. Now, in the old days, you could travel on anybody's property as long as they were willing to let you. You had, you know, the freedom to do that. But when the people started paying taxes, and so here's the real problem, because I want to be very constitutional on this. This, I have yet to see any state, because even before the states, these roads, these trails existed. So they didn't include, hey, we're going to make all the trails. We're going to blaze the trails and mark them for you. We're going to own that, and we're going to tax you for it. People said, you got to be kidding me. We're just going to ride our horse in that direction or this direction. So they didn't see the need for a highway system. They didn't see a need for lanes of commerce and improving commerce and trains and all these types of things. So what they did was they said, okay, over time, as property became purchased and there was less and less property around civilian, or I should say cities and in the urban areas and suburbs and so forth, we can literally see that there was no way anybody could literally travel in and out. So they had to create these through fares that they basically said, hey, look, you know, Pa and Ma Kettle, we're going to have to cut across your property because that's where this through fare is. And sometimes it got to a point where they had to pay for it. Once they paid for it, it was now public property. Now, as they started creating highways, now this was still free. And when I say still free, I'm literally telling you that at that point in time, you know, it was just horses and they didn't need to create laws and safety. Anything like that happened. There's no insurance involved in this scam, nothing else. But the point is that everything started developing and they actually started creating paved highways, improved roadways, where all of a sudden there was a good likelihood that you'd be sharing traffic with vehicles. This was the turn of the century. So as we grew, did they amend the Constitution? No, they didn't. But they started creating these rules, and they started establishing an order. We drive on the right side of the road here in America, and most of the world drives on the right side of the road, except for under the under Britain, and you know, you can see a map in Australia, New Zealand, and the British Commonwealth and so forth. I think in Canada they do drive on the right side. But that all being said, over time they started creating requirements. They you just couldn't get on the road as a 10-year-old in a car. You had to have a license because they wanted to make sure. And so most of these things aren't burdens or taxes. When you go get a license, you're only paying whatever, you know, $10, $20, whatever it is. I don't know how much it is in Louisiana, but whatever you pay for your license, that is literally the cost of the, you know, the state's administrative cost of making a person's license and the testing, whatever it takes to get that license. So you're just paying your, you know, I hate to say the fair share thing, but the, you're just paying what it costs. So the bottom line is they took it upon themselves without the constitutional authority, but there wasn't a lot of people saying this is unconstitutional. And as a matter of fact, I've yet to see any public, a state national or sovereign citizen challenged this, that it was unconstitutional. They just said, hey, you can't turn a right into a privilege. Absolutely they can. When they start using taxpayer money and they basically create an ownership of the land because they've bought up the land and they're basically plowing and paving and putting up signs and everything else. They're expending tax dollars to create a method or mechanism and or a, you know, I'll just say a system of transportation. They may not have the authority to do it, but here's the point. You prove your point today that it is unconstitutional because I'll help you. But the fact of the matter is the state and the people of that state, just like that, is going to amend the Constitution because they want a highway system. They want a waterway system. They want their rail system. They want transportation systems for commerce, for personal travel, business travel, for whatever purposes. They want it. Boy, is life more productive when we have a organized system. Wow, that's so great. So you can go down that road, but the day they do that, then every little whining part of your yap has to be shut because now they have the authority because the people have amended the Constitution to do so. You can tell me it's immoral or wrong to kill and say the United States has no authority to wage war. Well, it's right there in the Constitution. And if you want to change that, good luck, because changing that would then open the door for a lot of Second Amendment members to say, you won't have a Second Amendment right anymore. Because that's what ends up happening as that moral decay that's coming from these, I'll just say, these perverted minds, the way they see, you know, their entitlements. I'm a sovereign citizen. I do anything I want. I didn't buy into this system. These systems were perpetual. As a matter of fact, the parties to this government, or I should say the parties to the federal constitution, are the states. Every state that joined the constitution basically joined into that compact with their fellow states. They joined into the union to say, we will benefit underneath this constitution, under this delegation of power to this limited government, and we will also, you know, toil, and we will also suffer under those things, you know, by this government. But it is our job to keep them right. But they haven't been doing that. So, yeah, we've got some problems. But for you to think that you have this ability to get in a car and drive on a state highway or in a city highway, a town, a county highway, it doesn't matter. You can get in your car as long as you're riding on your own property and we will not bother you. You can ride across all your friends' properties. We will not bother you as long as they say it's okay. But once you get onto land that you're trespassing or you have no right to be on because that right has been taken, because that land has been purchased for the citizens of the state to be able to commit commerce, you're just an inhabitant now. And so you have no rights to be able to be on that. Constitutionally, legally, or even morally, you have no rights. Because even Christ would say, give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. And so, and as a matter of fact, it breaks the whole paradigm of being civil and getting along and working out the details with people. The problem is that we have these sovereign citizens that go down this path, that actually, you know, buy into this huge cockamamie thing. Now, what I just covered on this road system is only an example of how they use their perverted interpretation of the evolution of our government. Because when the Constitution was created, it ended the Articles of Confederation. Now, who created the Articles of Confederation? The states. And the states ratified it. And I'll tell you what, the states ratified it over, 6 years? It was created, drawn, and signed in 1777, and it wasn't ratified, fully ratified, until 1783. So it took 6 years. Now, when something better came along, the states abandoned, and they had the authority to abandon that compact. Under contract law, they could, and as a matter of fact, that's why the seventh article states what it does. That when nine states who are parties to that Articles of Confederation ratify this Constitution then goes into effect to replace it, but not to replace it for the other four states. Those other four states, if they don't ratify and they don't come in, they're still under the Articles of Confederation with the inability to do all the things that they couldn't do before. I mean, they'll still be impotent, they'll still be inept, and they'll still be incapable of enforcing anything under the Articles of Confederation. And happy they will be, inept and impotent. This new government actually gave the federal government the appropriate power to do what it needed to do. Granted, there has been plenty of things that have occurred where they have usurped power. That's a problem, and it's our job to fix those problems. Not to sit here and say, well, we got to get out of the system, because these problems are legitimate. In what kitty court do you get away with saying that? If it is illegitimate, you just because you call it and claim it legitimate doesn't make it so. So here's the burden that all of these sovereign citizens have. They have to prove that what was done was legitimately done. In other words, the government had the authority to create a corporation. The government had the authority to create a government out of the District of Columbia. That the federal government had the authority to create a treaty to subjugate us to the UN. Because you'll find, folks, every time, just like public land, the federal government had the authority to establish public land out of all of the states so they could sell that land to make money so that they could develop the District of Columbia. They started doing that in 1820. All of these things have been violations and usurpations. It's our job to clean these things up. Some of these things, we're not going to spend money to go into D.C. and flatten all the buildings. But because our forefathers chose not to do their job doesn't mean that it's still not our job to do. There has been no change whatsoever to the requirements of a U.S. citizen. A U.S. citizen is legally and morally obligated by that oath and by your birthright to defend and support that Constitution against enemies of the Constitution, whether they be domestic or foreign, and if necessary, to take up arms as the militia and as the state, as law will require to do so. Technically, these states, all they have to do is reestablish their militias and say, you know what, if necessary, we're kicking you out, government. You don't have the authority to do these things. Now, there are certain things that they can do that with because those require and are actually justified under what we've already read by Madison in his notes on nullification, that you have this authority to ultra interpose, to basically use whatever force necessary to protect and to serve or to save your sovereignty, to save your independence. They don't have a leg to stand on. They try to use the Civil War as a huge mechanism. The sovereign citizens, the General Assembly, all of these guys kind of, you know, pass the same crap around and they go, oh, look at this. And you know, the funny thing is, most of their real legitimacy that they, here's the legitimacy because it came from a judge in a court. A federal court judge said this. Show me in the Constitution where a federal judge actually has the power to redefine something in the Constitution. Because that's what they're doing. The Dillon ruling, you know, after the Civil War, basically said counties are not sovereign bodies. Let's show me in the Constitution where he had jurisdiction to even make that claim. He didn't. It should never have been in front of a federal judge. There's these problems called jurisdiction. And so every time we surrender our sovereignty and let something go in front of a court that has no jurisdiction over it, don't be surprised you don't get what you want. And oh, by the way, our justice and our remedies, or I should say our redress in a republican form of government is not to be done by the courts. It is to be done by our government, our representatives. Because remember, our government's republican, not judiciary. Every time I point these things out, you know, people go, well, you know, what do you mean we don't use the court? Well, we don't have a judiciary form of government. We're supposed to use the petitioning our government for the redress of grievances. yeah, that's the courts. And I go, no, they may be a part of our government, but we are not a judiciary form of government. We're a Republican form of government. Our representatives are the ones that create the laws, they can undo the laws, and they can redress our grievances. And we can prove this because they did this in the very beginning of this, of the creation of the United States. It's right there. Just read the annals of Congress and keep on reading through the Congressional Globe going up to the Civil War. They were still redressing grievances. It's just that the court started aggrandizing their power and convincing people that it would just be easier to do that. Because sometimes Congress or your representatives might just be too busy, might not understand the magnitude, but the courts, they're there for you. Not anymore, folks. As a matter of fact, they're just a corrupt cesspool, just like Congress is. And that's why when we look at the states, they're a corrupt cesspool, too. The only way out of this, we've been telling you and telling you, okay, in your mind, think of the deepest, truest blue you've ever seen before. That's my face. I have been telling and telling and telling you this, that we have to take back our counties and make them Republican in form. We're going to actually have to fight these patriots who have bought into this unsupported argument that your sheriffs are the most powerful person in your county. They're not. They were maybe under the British monarchical theocracy, but we broke away from that long before this U.S. Constitution. We started changing things. And under the Constitution, when every state started adapting a three-branch government, we put that idea of monarchy or executive power to asunder. So that your governor and your sheriffs aren't the ones ruling you anymore. You've created a bicameral legislative body. You've created three branches of government with an executive, the legislative being your sovereigns, and then this ancillary government to deal with controversies that is caused through government over those things within the Constitution. That's their jurisdiction. Your courts are tied to only what is in your Constitution. Is marriage in your Constitution? Yet we're going into their court to deal with marriage and divorce. Property disputes, common law disputes should not be in your state court. You should have a common law court because every state has common law. The problem is that the people that were rushing through to get to the Pacific Ocean and to create states and this sovereign mass of land, everybody cut corners. Nobody established a constitution for their county when we should have done that. But it doesn't mean you can't do it today. It doesn't mean you can't exert your authority as the citizens of that county and claim that government is yours, because it is a fundamental right under the Declaration of Independence, where we the people institute government. And when government no longer serves us, we have an inalienable right to alter and or abolish that government, and what we want to do is restore the government that we're supposed to have, and the way to do that is by instituting a constitution for your county government. And we'll walk you through the process, because, folks, this is not rocket science. If you can get yourself dressed, and you can manage to get your keys, you know, to lock your door, to start your car, to get to your office, do work, make money, get it into an account, and spend. If you're competent enough to function like that in society, you should be more than competent to understand, one, the Constitution, the self-governing system, and that you have a responsibility to do something about it. Now, this may hamper your ability to go to Circus or Circus Maximus and get your feed or your fill. Well, I'm being cut off here. So apparently the heavens have parted and said, shut up, GR, give these people a minute break. So I'm going to give you a minute break. But when I come back, I'm going to finish. Because we need to lay this asunder. We're going to get back into the Civil War and what happened and how this was all over slavery, because I still need to get there. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as I was saying, when we look at the Civil War, actually, we need to go back. As we've gone through these notes, we see how, and I said the other day, how we would have been better off leaving Georgia and the Carolinas out of the Union, biting the bullet and saying the Union, because you guys are isolated, just remember that whatever you do down there don't affect us. Because if a war breaks out, we have to come down and save your sorry butts, it's over. Slavery is over. Do you understand? Oh, okay. So you better start figuring out how to fix your process and system so that you're not hostage where you can't live and fight at the same time, fight a war. Because as far as we see it, Virginia could actually break out hostilities and just take over North Carolina by basically getting your slaves to rise up against you, just like what Britain tried to do. So had we gone down that path, it would have actually been resolved. But we didn't do that. And we clearly see in the Constitutional Convention where they were both speaking pragmatically as well as morally, that this was the wrong thing to do. Even though paradigms may not have even changed in the North. We saw some of the, I'll just call it empathetic Northerners, like Sherman was one of them, that literally said, well, I mean, this is slavery, that's your issue. I mean, we're not going to do it, and I don't have slaves, but, you know, I don't hate you because you have them. Like these other people, this was the awakening or the wokeness in the first phase of America. Had we done this, I think we would, I mean, folks, our whole paradigm would have been different moving forward. We would not have suffered that Civil War. Now, the South still would have suffered. The South still would have suffered because had we pushed them out and said, you're on your own, something would have happened. And if they actually made an agreement, I think the Monroe Doctrine would have been the Washington Doctrine, where Washington would say, hey, you know, colony, or I should say, hey, Britain, France, and nations of Europe, you want to come over and mingle on this continent? You're not welcome, and we're going to, if you start mingling with some of our former colonies and so forth, or states, then we're not going to allow that to happen and establish that doctrine to say we're basically taking cognitive power over this hemisphere, or at least the northwest or the western and the northern side of the hemisphere. In other words, the North American continent. Bottom line, that didn't happen. They made this huge mistake. Evidence was in the Constitution and in the ratification debates, which we're going to get into. And so I can't, you know, everybody that hears this, because if you're not listening to all of these shows, then you're going to miss these little things. Because when I highlight this, hey, here it is, this is the point right here where they decided to step aside away and move away from the constitutional design and insert the Missouri Compromise, giving the federal government unconstitutional authority to mandate slavery upon states. Because that's not there. And so that only proves that as they were moving forward under this three-fifths rule, the southern states realized that slavery was going to get eradicated because more and more states were joining as free states. They saw a state that they heavily invested in, Missouri, was going to become a free state because most of the people up there were freeholders and didn't have slaves. That the big plantations were actually at risk of losing their ability to have slave labor. So that's why they demanded that the federal government mandate slavery upon Missouri, because letting it go to a vote, they knew it would have failed. But the history books tell you otherwise. Because the history books, that's where you get all the truth. In the primary founding documents, you'll be surprised what truth comes out. And in the primary founding documents of where they actually had these honest debates of the Constitutional Convention, as well as the debates in the ratification of the Constitution, this is where they bared their souls, because at this point in time, they didn't know how people would be viewing in the, 200-300 years from their time, looking at them like, what a repugnant pig, thinking that they could have slaves and possess people like that. Because that's how we judge people today, because our paradigms have changed significantly. You have to think, but back in those days, slavery was like putting and holding your pants up with a belt or with suspenders. It was a tool. It was a mechanism of taking care of labor. And they didn't give it any other thought. For thousands of years, it was a tool for labor. Right, wrong, or indifferent, it existed for all that time. And the fact be told, America did not, and the U.S. government did not create slavery. And we go through this show how we show how the black slavery was established by the monarch, by the British monarch in the 1660 something. It's actually my first book because I covered this. That's when they said the slaves that are going to be in the colonies of North America will be black and black only. You will not be able to have white slaves or any other nationality of slaves. They must be black. Interesting. They knew what they were doing that far ahead in creating an ability to manipulate. As a matter of fact, I mean, with that same evil thought, here's a great way of outsourcing our penal system. Let's put all the white people in black nations. Let's put all the Mexicans up in Scandinavia and so forth, or I should say brown-skinned people up where there's nothing but white skin. So if you break out of prison, people are going to instantly, well, that's got to be a prisoner because they don't live here. So by doing that, by actually creating that dichotomy so that you have this big contrast of the society, the people that are freely moving around, there's no way you could ever risk trying to break out because there's nobody out there that would not recognize you as a prisoner. You can't just melt in. Do that. Because this is how we learn from history, right? Just alleviate, or you can't even speak the language. And when somebody adapts.
Why they used Australia as a colony for the white people.
Well, they did that, absolutely, because it was the only other race there was the Aborigines, and the Aborigines just basically left them alone anyway.
Right.
So it's not like, and they spoke a different language, so it wasn't like they could commingle. I mean, it was truly a barrier, absolutely. So anyway, when we look at what ended up happening, because the mandate of Missouri becoming a slave state, the abolition movement grew and grew. The northern states started actually creating unconstitutional rules. They were called the Tariffs of Abomination by John C. Calhoun. John C. Calhoun came up with this concocted idea of nullification. And this is why Madison kept on saying, and I know, Sean, we read through this, that in the nullification, notes on nullification, a single state or a group of states, without it being a majority, cannot nullify federal law. If it's a uniform law being applied to all of the states, they must stand up and say, this is unconstitutional. The problem is, all of the northern states were happy because it was adversely affecting the southern states. This goes to the back of Madison's notes on nullification, where ultra interposition would be allowed. In other words, taking up arms and saying, we're not going to pay these taxes. The problem was that these were on import goods coming into America, so it was hard for the southern states to avoid this economic warfare that was being waged from the northern states. As things progressed, it got to a point where they realized that with Lincoln coming in, and if you read the Douglas debates, both Lincoln and Douglas, as a matter of fact, if you ask me, Douglas was far more amenable and far more accepting of blacks and slaves than Abraham Lincoln. If you've never read the Douglas debates, and I know Sean's going to go get this. This is in my first book, by the way. I have a few citations where they actually bring it up. And Lincoln's position was far worse than Douglas's. But it didn't matter because both of them were northern men. And both of them were basically being viewed by the southern states that one of them, whoever gets elected, is going to try to end slavery. But peace to you southerners. Don't worry, because when Lincoln did win, he wrote this concessionary amendment and offered it to them. And it was an amendment that would galvanize slavery in the Constitution. It was the 13th Amendment. Technically, it was going to be the 14th, but it was rejected. But he guaranteed that it was rejected because the southern states started seceding. He guaranteed that he could get the northern states, enough northern states, to basically accept and ratify that amendment. They saw there was no way that was going to happen, and they chose to secede. And when you read the secession letters, there were only four secession letters that were formally delivered. No more were basically delivered because by that time, Lincoln disbanded Congress. Now, most everything that Lincoln did was unconstitutional. He thought he was the king. He did so many things that are unconstitutional. I'm not going to sit here and waste up a lot of our content time going over it. He was a bad man. And he basically, as I tell people, when you really look at this man's life, he was in the Army as a captain. He had a law degree. I don't know if he had a JD or whatever they had. I think they had JDs back then. But nevertheless, he was a lawyer. And he was a pauper. I mean, he wasn't rich. He wasn't well-to-do. Some people make, there's all sorts of things to talk about Lincoln and his evil background, his evil seed, his ancestry, so forth and so on. I'm not going to go there. I will go into his history, though. He was a captain in the Army, or in the cavalry, and was kicked out as a private. He failed in the Army. And as a matter of fact, when you go through his professional career, he failed and failed and failed and failed. He failed so many times that if you've ever met somebody that has done something that has happened to them, so many times they become so hardened that they become triggered, that's the best word for it, they get triggered when all of a sudden it looks like that's going to happen to them again. And they will do anything and everything necessary to not let that happen again. And therefore, when Lincoln stepped into the presidency and was sworn in and the secession notes started coming in, and he saw the Union basically falling apart under his presidency, where he would once again be known as a failure. And guess what? God hardened him to that point. I think God hardened, because remember what Mason said, right? Mason said, God cannot punish nations and states in heaven. So he will punish this nation and these states. and he will deliver a calamity. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, folks, but Mason basically stated that because they didn't do the right thing, that we were going to suffer. Now, again, there were steps along the way that we could have got it right by not passing the Missouri Compromise, and allowed us to eradicate it naturally. But no, we allowed this swamp that had already formed over this division or this divisive tactic of slavery. And ergo, everything was, the die was cast. We were going to head into a calamity that was going to cost us. And God gave us a man in that presidential seat that literally lost it. He had no common sense, no reason. He had no constitutional understanding. He didn't understand the Constitution. He did whatever he wanted. As when Taney came up to him and told him that what he was doing was unconstitutional, he basically looked down at this little man and said, "I'd like to see you enforce that." And people died in captivity. He arrested people that were he considered, you know, loyalists to liberty. Those people that weren't going to go along with the scheme, they were arrested, and many people died in captivity. It was that bad. Most people don't understand how bad it was under Lincoln. But it had nothing to do with freeing the slaves. Nothing to do with freeing the slaves. I had a conversation the other day with, and maybe it was on this line or what have you, about Lincoln really having this hate towards blacks in his administration and so forth, and there was just this real hate towards blacks. And Frederick Douglass, you know, he held his nose. And because he was a reporter, he had the right to be there. He was constantly yammering and giving Lincoln a hard time, to where finally, when Lincoln finally made the Civil War about slavery and freeing the slaves, instead of "you can't leave the Union," because we were losing the war on that whole strategy, "you can't leave the Union." So now it was about slavery. And then when that war finally ended, Lincoln was looking, well, what can we do? What can I do? And it wasn't looking good. It was not looking good. Lincoln wanted to basically create a welfare state and welfare system, which was the whole Reconstruction concept, which, because of his death, it didn't live this long life. Because back in those days, there was no limitation to terms. And Lincoln could have easily become a king and president for years and years and years by using a welfare state, by basically violating the Constitution, by giving reparations. As a matter of fact, it was Frederick Douglass that was the voice of reason in the wilderness, telling him, "Let the people go. Just let them go. Don't worry about, you know, anything else. They just want to be free. Let them go. Don't hold them back into these states where, you know, you're going to, you know, rebuild and you're going to divvy up the states." Because what he was going to do was he was going to create and bake in a divisive system that would have been worse than what we have today. So the point is this, is that the southern states had every right to secede. The fact of the matter is they did secede. If they weren't able to secede, then they weren't able to leave the Union, which means after the Civil War, they would have been able to come right back in and start occupying their desks in Congress. But oh no, they seceded. They left those desks, and they set up desks down in Richmond, Virginia, in the new Confederate government. And in creating that new Confederate government, they were all bought in on this, you know, this, I'll just say, you know, magical world of Disney, that they were going to get away with, you know, however they wanted to treat human beings and do what they wanted to do. Well, the war changed, the focus changed, and they were conquered. And as the conquerors, we had to be the power, and the Constitution clearly states that Congress has the power to admit states into the Union. They left the Union. And so people had a problem with, and some people pointed out that the second 13th Amendment that passed, technically it should be the 14th, but the ending of slavery, what we call the 13th Amendment, that actually was supposedly passed by some southern states. Some southern states were allowed to ratify. Well, it doesn't surprise me. Lincoln did whatever he wanted to do. And he got some certain states to maybe be able to pass it. But it wasn't done as a united Congress. The Congress was still separated. And it didn't go through the process because it was not brought up through Congress through the process and then sent out to the states in the Union. It wasn't done via Congress. It was done via Lincoln. Lincoln didn't have the power to do that. Now, is there a problem with the 13th Amendment? I don't see a problem with it. There's no boogeyman there, so I don't see why we would need to do anything other than let people know the whole truth. It's like Wyoming became a state in the Union. Congress allowed it to become a state, but they became a state outside of Congress giving them an enabling act. They came in without, you know, Congress meddling and so forth, because they actually meddled themselves. They voluntarily meddled for Congress. And they came in and said, look, we want to join the Union, and we've created a constitution that you would be very proud of because we're doing things that we shouldn't have to do that you're demanding. And we've done all the things that unconstitutionally want us to do. So they did it, and they looked at it, and they go, okay, we'll let you in. The real reason why they didn't want Wyoming to come into the Union and why Wyoming snuck under the door was because Wyoming wanted to let women vote. Wyoming was the first state, and they have the if you want to call it, the glory on being the first state open to allowing women to vote, women's suffrage. That's fact. So when we look at what was happening with the states coming back into the Union after the Civil War, Congress had every power. They had the power to keep them as territories. And therefore, when the 14th Amendment was written, they basically said, you'll be allowed to join the Union once the 14th Amendment is ratified. Why? Because they knew that the southern states were killing and oppressing the freemen. Killing and oppressing. There was a huge massacre that nobody gets taught in Louisiana, where over 200 black freedmen were killed by, you know, law enforcement, political activists, and government players, all went into this convention where these black freedmen were trying to, you know, get organized politically so that they could get into office. They were all murdered. So this happened in 1866, folks. So don't tell me that the 14th Amendment was not necessary. And as a matter of fact, it became a national referendum between Andrew Johnson, who was saying, hey, the South is behaving perfectly. They're angels down here. You know, as a matter of fact, I have to tell you, because of what I learned as a young man and what I knew, I always had a, you know, this bad paradigm that when I heard a Southern drawl, I heard a liar behind that, because I had learned about all these lies because my father was in political science. So when I was a teenager, a lot of this stuff was already coming out. We're living in the age of information. And so, you know, still to this day, the hair on the back of my neck just comes up when I hear the Russian accent, because I lived and was programmed. They were the enemies and we were going to kill them. We had to kill them. It was us or them. As a Marine for 20 years, they were the enemy. And then, well, the enemy pool got bigger, but anyway. The point is this, folks, that Congress opened the door to let these states in if they ratified, and Tennessee was one of the few states that ratified. They even made the irresistible object in the 14th Amendment. In other words, they gave the southern states a benefit, a no-brainer, to come in, to ratify it, to come in, because the fourth section of the 14th Amendment meant that any state that was in the Union, even if they had debt with Britain, that this constitutional amendment expunged that debt from them. They weren't obligated to pay any debt to any nation over the rebellion. And the most important part of the 14th Amendment that we all, it is the godsend to us today, is Section 3. Because this is where they ended this concept that public servants could violate their oath and be in good terms as a public servant. No, they're to be removed immediately. They have violated their oath. They are no longer eligible because it became an eligibility standard, which is why Section 3 starts off as no person shall be. When you look at the limitations placed upon a senator and a representative, that's exactly how it started. This is a hardcore qualification eligibility standard. You violate your oath, you are no longer eligible. Get out. You're done. But we don't have the ability to enforce it because Satan has this grasp on all everybody that looks, because we've got conservatives, we've got progressives. Everybody hates the 14th Amendment, which is why I challenge everybody to really, really look and examine at all the primary source documents and look at look at the Congressional Globe as these men debated the 14th Amendment, and you will see that everybody's been lying to you. There has been no design of creating corporations. There was no design of creating the subjectivity of men by making all blacks and Indians citizens of the United States. The design was not to subjugate the people. All of that happened via court redefining, via the interpretation of the court. It has been the court that has been our bane of our existence. And it has been the court basically acting as the monkeys on a string to the British organ, because the organ grinder has been the British Empire behind all of these little things. Why? Because Britain was pissed off that they couldn't get their pound of flesh out of the southern states. Because they, if you really look at it, after the Civil War, what was to keep Britain from foreclosing on these southern states to actually be able to come to the United States and say, you know, this is now a Commonwealth of Britain because you can't pay the debt, you've now become ours. So as we look at, the Monroe Doctrine would have had to kick in, so Britain probably would have had to face a war. But bottom line is that that 14th Amendment is a godsend. And so hopefully... And I apologize, Sean, that I've kind of commandeered the whole show to cover this, all this content. But hopefully...
No, I appreciate the insight, sir.
Okay.
Because you're right. We have a lot of people who are stuck on these ridiculous fairy tales, and they're not willing to even go look it up or go to the original sources or look at themselves in the mirror and understand where they actually stand. Instead, they'd rather follow these ridiculous... rabbit trails that lead nowhere and actually waste time, resources, and energy as our country is steadily declining.
And they're feeding the fire. They're throwing fuel on the fire.
And when you think about it, it's just as ridiculous as a lot of the woke stuff coming from the left.
Right. Well, thank you for joining. Thank you for being a part of this. And folks, hopefully this puts an end to any arguments you hear, one about the 14th Amendment, about the states being denied coming in, that the 14th Amendment was a violation, those are all lies. They may be in the congressional record, but lies are filled within the congressional record. And this is why we go to the original congressional record on the 14th Amendment to prove our points. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.